When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Welcome to Face to Face. This is a show about change and about what's next. It's a show that wants to ask questions, peel back the layers of our average everyday experience, and go beyond scratching the surface. We interview amazing people with incredible ideas and stories who have done wild, weird, and wonderful things. Remember that imagination shared create collaboration, and collaboration creates community, and community inspires social change. I'm David Peck, and this is Face to Face.
Hi, David.
Hello, Bridget. How are you?
Well, how are you?
I am pretty good, thanks.
That's good. I'm glad we could finally connect.
Yes, I am too, and I apologize for Monday, but I appreciate it. Willingness.
Yeah, that's nice.
I wasn't sure where you were actually at, I think, when I first started talking to the publicist about timing and so on, and it sounded, I think, like you were traveling, but you're based in Australia, right?
Yeah, I'm based in Australia. I've been in Sri Lanka, so I just got back.
Maybe that's what it was.
Yeah, and where have you been? You've been in Southeast Asia?
Yeah, so I work for the past almost 20 years, I guess now, I've been working in, full-time gig, working in international development, and so I've worked with a lot of different agencies and been able to do a fair bit of traveling. And I was just in Bangladesh working on some public engagement stuff on a fairly significant Canadian project up there, working with mothers and farmers on a biofortified rice project, actually. And it's pretty cool. And then I was able to get down into Cambodia as well for about a week. I've been working in Cambodia since 2003, and have been just in the last 4 years started working on a small documentary film, and it has kind of taken over my life in some respects. And as I'm sure you can only appreciate too well, I would think, being, you know, having done the work that you've done for so many years, it's, you know what, it's weird, Bridget, it's kind of gone beyond, I don't even know if this makes sense, but it's gone beyond a passion project, and now it's like, I don't know, project of purpose, maybe. I'm going for the alliteration here, but there's something about it that it's gotten into my blood, and now I need to make this. Like, this has to happen.
Oh, that's fantastic.
It's kind of cool. It is. I'm not complaining.
It's a great feeling.
It is a great feeling, yeah. And the challenge now is going to be trying to find some funding. And so we were able to do some more recording. And what's really cool is I was able to introduce all the key principles, both in Siem Reap and Phnom Penh, to my new director of photography, a young filmmaker out of Vancouver. And he knows everyone now. And he can go back on his own. And so it's going to save us. It's going to save us time. It's going to save us money. We're going to be able to follow the story, I think, even in a more intimate way. So it's pretty cool. Yeah, it's pretty
fantastic.
Neat. Yeah.
Have you got a release date, or is that too far off?
Yeah, you know, it's funny. I'm hoping we're going to be submitting to, you know, some of the more significant festivals within the next 18 months. So that's the plan. But it could be a tiny bit longer. It kind of just depends on the principal photography. I'd say we're 60% of the way there. Website just came live. I've got a fundraising deck that I've just put together. I've got a new treatment, and I've got a production company in Toronto, or sorry, Ottawa, Ontario, that are interested. So we'll see. I mean, it's, as you know, this stuff it's really hard to do and to pull off. And I'm not trying to make any money on it, but I would like people to get paid, you know, for their effort and their involvement, you know? So anyway, it's called Broken Courage. And
Broken Courage.
And it is.
Put me on the mailing list so I can keep track of the film.
Oh, well, thank you.
Yeah, if it has an Australian release, it would be good to support it.
Well, I will, and we're really proud of what we've got so far. And it's a film about a child soldier who became ultimately a Khmer Rouge leader. He got deeply involved in the Khmer Rouge, and then he fought with the Cambodian army for a few years, lost a leg to a landmine, and then he started a landmine a war museum. And he's been working in and out of that, sort of this whole idea of you know, telling his story over and over. And so the film's about storytelling. It's about healing. It's about this beautiful country called Cambodia. But it's really, honestly, Bridget, it's become a film about mental health issues, actually. And,
oh, okay.
And it's about PTSD and trauma. And that's Broken Courage is a direct English translation from a Khmer word that is the closest translation to post-traumatic stress disorder that you can get. So it's... it's cool. It's really interesting, and I think that's where you can probably hear it in my voice, but I get pretty excited about it, because I think it's not only going to be a great film, I think there's an opportunity for some social like a social change campaign of a sort that could come out after the film or alongside of it as well. So anyway.
Yeah.
Well, thanks for thanks for listening. And
No, that's okay. It's really interesting. I don't know a lot about Cambodia. I've traveled a lot to Asia, but, you know, it sounds like something that, you know, is going to make a really interesting film and educate a lot of people.
I hope so, and we're probably, and this might not appeal to you as a journalist, but we're probably going to stay away from the political side of things.
Yeah.
And as you know, you know, Australia's been in the news of late with Cambodia, and I've forgotten his name right now, but the filmmaker that was just released.
James Richardson, yeah.
Thank you. And anyway, I've been going there since 2003, and I would say this was, there was more tension sort of on this visit than I've noticed before. I was talking to a Khmer man, and he looked at a plant in front of me, and he said, you know, democracy was like that plant here up until a month ago. And he just, and then he went, and now, and he just kind of waved his hands, you know, and I think people are really discouraged in Cambodia right now, but I hope I hope and trust it's a bit of a hiccup, but, anyway, we'll see what happens, but, So you were in Sri Lanka.
Yeah. I was just doing some travel writing there. There in the Maldives for about a month, which was, you know, a fairly long trip.
That is a long trip.
But it was also very relaxing. So
okay,
it was good fun.
You were in a good spot.
I was traveling around, so I was like,
oh okay.
I was pretty much on the road constantly. I went around the country clockwise. So yeah, and then into the interior. So yeah, I don't know if you've been to Sri Lanka, but it's fantastic.
I have not.
Oh, it's so nice.
Oh,
yeah.
Cool.
I mean, it has its share of problems, but it's actually, I think, you know, on the up.
Oh, okay. Well, that's a good sign. I mean, I was supposed to, Colombo, right? Is that the capital?
Yeah, that's the capital.
Yeah, I was supposed to go there a few years back. I was on a trip coming out of Hong Kong or something. I've done a fair bit of traveling over the years, not so much in the last five, but I never did wind up going. So, well, I'll, you know, maybe that goes on the bucket list.
Yeah.
Well, listen, we've kind of chatted a little bit, but I'd love to just chat a little bit more like this. It's great. I feel like I know you already, and it's probably partially because of some of the research I've done and reading through your book, which I've loved, by the way.
Thank you.
Yeah, and from my understanding, it's done pretty well, right? Like you've been really busy with this book. Am I right?
Well, I spent about 10 years, you know, doing the research, and then wrote it in a couple of years. So my work as a travel journalist and reporter has sent me all over the world, and my particular focus was on wellness. And, you know, when the wellness industry started becoming a really big deal, I had enough material for a book.
Interesting. So you were ahead of the mark on this one.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Unfortunately, I didn't monetize any of it, but I have been able to observe it.
Oh, cool. Okay. Well, that's good to know. So, I'm recording, but I'm not recording, if you know what I mean. And, I'll bring us in sort of formally in a couple minutes. Bridget, am I pronouncing your name right, by the way, Bridget?
Yeah, that's correct.
And it's Delaney, correct?
Yeah, that's right.
A couple questions. Is there anything you don't want me to talk about? And is there anything you specifically do want me to talk about, you know, like your travel project or kind of what's next for you, or, you know, happy to do that. I have a decent social media following. It's not huge, but it's decent. And I do have an audience. So happy to do that for you. But also if there's nothing that bubbles to the surface right away, you could always let me know as well. And then we'll do about 20 tweets on it. We'll publish it on Facebook. And then it will go up on a rabble.ca as well. That's a fairly significant news agency here in Canada. And the tagline is news for the rest of us. It's kind of left. I'm pretty sure this interview will appeal to their demographic as well. So I've got my own sort
fantastic.
Of list. Yeah. So there's a couple different platforms, and then all the usual suspects, of course. We've kind of covered everything. I usually try to get to know my guests for a few minutes at least, if I'm not face to face. Always want to make sure that I don't. Yeah, I'm not really a journalist. I'm a conversationalist, and that's kind of.
Yeah, no, that sounds great.
Yeah.
I mean, a lot of podcasts, you know, they're more about the conversation and the people connecting rather than, you know, some sort of probing.
I'm not interested.
You know, investigation.
I mean, if I probe, it's only because I want to clarification or, hey, that's fascinating. Yeah. Can we get more goods on that? I'm not interested in the dirt. Like, I'm not looking for the big story here. I really am. It's, to me, it is social change and getting people excited about things that matter, to me, is a conversation. So, yeah, so that's what I've been trying to do here for the last 5 years or so. I'm coming up on 400 interviews, so I'm quite thrilled.
Fantastic.
Quite thrilled about that. Yeah, so.
Yeah. Well, look, there's nothing that I'm particularly sensitive about, and there's nothing, you know, I need to focus on. So, I'll just let you go ahead.
Okay. Well, then let's do that. Let's just dive in here. If you give me about 30 to 40 seconds, I will bring us in. Mm-hmm. Oh, and how long are you good for? Are you good for about 30 minutes?
Yeah, I'm good for 30 minutes.
All right. And we can, you know, and oh, that's the other thing. If either of us says anything, you know, wildly offensive or politically unsettling, I'm happy to take it out.
That's okay. I've done like, the book came out last year in Australia, so I've done quite a lot of media, so I'm pretty not polished, but I'm pretty good at doing live interviews and stuff, so
good.
This
excellent
will be fine.
Fantastic. Totally tell.
And if you send me the link, I can put it out on all my social media as well when it comes out.
Sounds great. We'll do that. Is there anything coming up that you'd like to time it with? Like, I'm happy to sit. Like, often I'll interview filmmakers, and I mean, I'm sitting on about three right now that I did about, honestly, two, three months ago, waiting for the theatrical release. I know the book's already been out, but anything you've got coming up that we could use to sort of...
No. I'm about to start a new book.
Oh, good.
But that is yet to be written, so that won't be for a while.
Okay. Got it. All right, well, give me a second here, and I'm going to bring us in.
Yep.
Well, welcome to Face to Face. We're joined by a very special guest here today, all the way from Australia, believe it or not. We have Bridget Delaney here with us on the line today to talk about her new book, Wellmania: Extreme Misadventures in the Search for Wellness. Bridget, thank you for joining us today on Face to Face.
Thank you, David. It's a pleasure to be here.
My listeners will know that what I'm about to say. I'm old enough to still be blown away by how great of a connection we have here online. It's
amazing.
It's just remarkable. How far are you away? What are you, 14,000 kilometers away from here right now, from Toronto, and we're having this virtual face-to-face conversation. Wonderful.
Well, I know that I went to Toronto last year and took about three or four flights and, you know, many days in the air. So it's much easier to speak via Skype.
It's not quite as exhausting, right? Let's hope not anyway.
Yeah.
So, Extreme Misadventures in the Search for Wellness. I mean, there's so many laugh out loud moments. And by the way, congratulations. I know I'm a little late to the game on this. Your book was published last year, and you've been having some great success with it. Maybe you can give us kind of the more generic overview of what it's about, what your kind of goals were. I know you were researching this for 10 years, and then I've got some fun questions for you. And I love your sense of humor, by the way. It comes out in so many different ways. And I think one of my favorite moments is near the beginning of the book, and I'll see if I can find it. But I think you were out at a bar, and the line was something like, "Help me out here, but the difference between me and this man was only one drink." It's one of my favorite moments in the book. But so Wellmania, Extreme Misadventures in the Search for Wellness. Do tell.
So about 10 or 15 years ago, I started doing a lot of travel journalism, particularly around Asia and in Australia. And I noticed that there was a real trend for retreats, spa holidays. And I started going on these and documenting people's experiences. And then a few years ago, I realized that this industry had been growing enormously. It was now worth, you know, $14.7 trillion, more than the pharmaceutical industry and many other industries. And I thought the time was ripe to have a look at it, to see what works, what doesn't work, but also look at it with a sense of humor, because some of the things that people in the wellness industry get up to are kind of funny, but they take themselves a bit too seriously.
You talk about right near the beginning of the book, and I'm going to find the quote because I know I underlined it, but you talked about this sense of being out of whack.
I think that's a common thing. So there's a lot of abundance in many countries in the world today, Canada, Australia, the UK, the US. And I've been living in New York, and I just had too much food, too much booze. I felt uncomfortable in my skin. And I just didn't have that sense of vitality that I should have as someone who's not sick. And so I looked at how the wellness industry promises to restore that.
Right.
And if, in fact, it does restore it. And, you know, what are the factors that mean we don't have vitality? And one of them is, of course, like lack of sleep, lack of kind of time to prepare fresh, healthy food, kind of no breaks on the fact that if you are in a big city and want to go out every night, you know, for me at that time, that was a possibility. So I overdid it, and then the wellness industry kind of stepped in and corrected that.
So this was your attempt at regaining what you lost in your college and university years? Is that what you're saying?
Well, I think it's I think I definitely wanted to lose weight, and I definitely wanted to just be a bit more I don't know, just feel a bit better on,
right.
on a yep. mental level, an emotional level, definitely a spiritual level.
Well, you talk, you know, it's interesting, the out of whackness. I've just come back. We chatted before we were, you know, recording our conversation today about travel, and you do a fair bit of it. Sri Lanka. I'm just back from, you know, Cambodia, Bangladesh. I'm really not feeling well yet, right? You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And your system is just off, and it's off on so many levels. And I actually looked up, and it wasn't even in connection to sort of researching doing this interview with you, but you know, jet lag and, you know, solutions, et cetera, you know, because you're melatonin, you're always looking for the easy way out, I suppose, right? But I cannot believe the stuff that I found on jet lag, you know, depression, anxiety, stomach disorders, irritable bowel. I mean, the list just goes on. So I think, I mean, you've clearly hit a nerve. I mean, economically, we've hit a nerve with $14.7 trillion is almost absurd. But I think a lot of us do feel kind of unwell, don't we?
We do, and it's not just a physical unwellness. It's a sense of not connecting to a kind of quieter, more I guess more spiritual dimension. One of the things that I found really interesting was that smartphones have, you know, technology has made people's lives better.
Right.
But people don't feel like they're getting any time off from the internet or from being connected or from social media. And that causes quite a bit of anxiety. And so there are all these places springing up, all these retreats that are trying to wean people off their phones, that are trying to get them into a place of stillness or quiet, connecting with something that's not tech-based. And I think this is a problem for anyone that lives in the West and is kind of glued to their phones, which is a lot of us.
It's a lot of us. And I think we underestimate the amount of time we spend with our necks at, what, I don't know, 33 degrees, whatever it is, looking down like that. Yeah. Do you think, you know, you ask in the introduction right out of the gate, you know, the important question for you is why? Right? The deeper question is why. So appeals to me. My background academically is philosophy. It's not just about the wellness industry itself, but why are they offering it to us? Do you think part of that answer came, what do I want to ask here? The intention. I guess, is it all about money? Is it about the $14.7 trillion? Or is it a little bit more comprehensive and holistic than that?
I mean, like any industry, the wellness industry has people that are genuinely wanting to help others and do it very altruistically. It's also got big business who've become attached, and it's got a number of people who are snake oil salespeople.
Right.
You know, they claim to be healers, or they'll claim that if you go to this particular resort or take this supplement, you'll heal your cancer or your digestive problems. I didn't go into this in the book, but one of the interesting news stories coming out of Australia recently was a young wellness blogger who claimed to have cured her own brain cancer by rejecting chemotherapy and drinking lots of juice. And she had, you know, hundreds of thousands of followers and people who were very sick who were taking her advice, and she turned out not to have cancer at all. So, and she's now before the courts. Wow. So there's that aspect of the wellness industry which is really sharky, but there's also a tradition, like I go to a Benedictine monastery in the book. You know, there's a tradition of helping others, taking people in who are having a hard time, and doing it on pretty much a not-for-profit basis. So there's the whole range.
Tell me a little bit about the – you kind of – I'm going to say that you knew this book was coming a long time ago. Were you prepping – when you were doing the research, were you prepping for Wellmania? Did you realize what you were stepping into?
No. Look, I wasn't, because I was doing it on assignment for various newspapers. So,
right.
And I also am a mad journal keeper. So I keep a lot of – I keep a diary almost constantly. So I had a huge amount of information, both kind of hard information about the places that I was – going to, and also my more internal journey when I was, you know, at various retreats or at various points in my life, I could refer to a diary that might be 10 years old and suddenly I was back there. So in many ways, I guess I'm prepping for any type of book that might come from my own life because of the methods that I use.
You mentioned a diary. I think you've been keeping one, if I remember correctly, for over about 20 years.
Yeah, that's correct.
And is that a daily thing for you? Is it are you
no.
that?
No, it's not. It's basically it's a great way to fill in time particularly if I'm on a journey, if I'm on a train,
right.
or
yep.
if I'm waiting somewhere, if I'm waiting for someone. I carry it with me all the time. It's
nice.
A paper journal. I just whip it out. I might only write 3 or 4 lines a month. But if I'm traveling, you know, I tend to spend more time on recording things. But look, there'll be months that go by where, you know, I don't sort of make a mark. But I have a column in The Guardian each week called Bridget Delaney's Diary. And that effectively acts as a very public journal about what's happening in my life.
So the reason I wanted to go there is I think, and I'm just flipping through here quickly trying to find it in the book, but you talk about your being no stranger to self-observation, and I mean, to me, you know, really appeals to me, it appeals to the existentialist in me, Bridget, if that makes any sense at all, you know, this idea of becoming a more authentic, you know, person, a more authentic self. What does it mean to be a better human being? How can I be a better husband, a better parent, a better friend, you know, a better podcaster, and so on? And isn't it about being able to self-observe and reflect? And but I think at that point in the book, you also talk about, which I just find so funny, about being dishonest. And it's just, it's interesting that you're honest enough to tell us that you're dishonest. I just see the sort of the irony of that. But can you talk about that? Isn't that what Wellmania is about, really, in a sense? It's about that search for self, that authentic self, isn't it?
I'm trying to remember the bit where I talked about being dishonest.
I'm going to find it, so.
Yeah. Look, everyone has the capacity to fool themselves.
Right.
And...
Oh, here, I got it. I've got it. I'm a first-person journalist. Quote, I've kept a diary for 20 years. I've been on dozens of retreats. I am no stranger to self-observation. Yet still, like most people, I can be dishonest with myself. Being honest can be painful, and it may lead to an acknowledgement that things need to change, and change is hard, close quote. And then you go on to talk. It's in the lean section. And by the way, I want to get to that, the clean, lean, and serene. But yeah, being honest is painful, right? And and change is hard. That's so good.
It is. And I think you can go on these retreats, which might be for a week in Bali.
Why is it always Bali or Costa Rica? Yeah, it's
there are countries whose economy is propped up by the wellness industry, and they are two such places. But you go on these things and you think that your life will change when you get back. But often we just fall into old habits, old patterns. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. The week fades, like the tan fades. And, unless we're really willing to change aspects of our everyday life, these things don't have a long-lasting impact.
You know, there's so many questions. Are you going to live to 101?
Definitely not. I don't want to.
You did the 101 day detox, right?
Yeah.
And that's my question after reading that section was, are you actually going to make it?
No, I won't make it. I mean, maybe I will, but I suspect that most of my friends will be dead by then, and it won't be a lot of fun being 101 by myself.
Yeah, you won't be hanging out at that bar till 3 a.m., will you?
Definitely not.
What do you call it? What is it? The Oporto at 3 a.m.? Is that what it was? Yeah. Sounds like a poem that you should write in the very near future. Yeah. Why would you want to live to 101 unless you really had your health, I guess, is the question. So what are some of the practices that from your research and your travels and so on, what have you kept?
So I've kept meditation. And meditation is easy to keep. Like it's portable. So I travel a lot, and meditation is something that once you learn how to do it, there's no cost. You can do it anywhere. Mm. You just need 20 minutes, 30 minutes a day, and a quiet space, and off you go. So meditation, I think, is fantastic, and it does work definitely for me. I think sleep is a really massive one. Once again, it's free. You can pretty much do it anywhere. But I just noticed that my equilibrium and my mood, everything improves if I've had a decent sleep. And some of the wisest people I met during the course of researching this book were people that didn't engage with fads. They were one guy was a farmer from Northern Australia who was in incredibly good shape. He was in his late 70s, very, very fit. And he just had one or two beers a week, exercised every day, so did physical work on his farm, ate produce that he grew himself, and not too much of it, but also didn't deprive himself. He was traveling a lot. He was curious. He had a community around him, and that's kind of what I aspire to. But we were talking – I met him on a trip in Central Australia, and we were talking about – turmeric lattes, and he had no idea what we were talking about, and he just thought the whole thing sounded ridiculous. So there's something in that.
Well, it's it is interesting. It just when you said that, it made me think of I get some of the vitamins that I get from a local health store that I use from time to time. I'm there a few times a month, and it is interesting to see, speaking of fads, what's on the countertop each time, and kind of what stays. Was this just a salesperson who came in and had 24 of these and they got rid of them, or is this something that actually is really going to make a difference in people's lives? But one of the things that seems to stick around is some drink, I think it is, that you can take the morning after if you've been drinking too much. So I think this taps into quite nicely too your commentary around, excess and just wanting the quick fix in I think it's in the clean section of the book. But here it is, $6.95. Take this with you the next time you go on binge drinking, road show with a few of your friends. Drink that in the morning. You're going to feel better. Right?
I mean, maybe just don't binge drink.
That's right. Well, yeah.
You don't need the thing. I mean, that's a lot of the problem is that we are given, kind of permission by the market to engage in all this bad behavior. We're encouraged through advertising and all these other things.
That's a
and
funny
then
line.
The cure. So,
right, and then sold the cure. Exactly.
Yeah. So I think it's just really important to be aware of that dynamic of how the market you know, corrupts us then tries to save us. And that's why things that are for free, like meditation and sleep and spending time with friends, you know, working in your community or being involved in community work, that stuff's not monetized. And it just happens to be some of the healthiest behaviors that you can engage in.
I want to ask you about relationships and community and friendships and so on and mental health in a second. But can you talk a little bit about that? That sense of corruption. Like how much of this, you know, is really by design, and at what point does it become dangerous? You know, you talk about the woman who said she was cured of brain cancer. I think of faith healers, right, who have done similar things, who make these outrageous claims, and these flim-flam men over the years, you know, the elixir of life back in the early 1900s. At what point are you actually duping people? No, you really actually should be going to see a doctor about that. Where does modern science fit into all this as well? There's about six questions wrapped up in there, I think.
I'll take the last one about science. You know, that was a real issue when I was researching the book, particularly when I was researching fasting. There's not a lot of studies on humans about what happens when you fast for long periods of time and what the benefits are. So I did quite a lengthy fast for the book, which was a fascinating and fairly grueling process. But I found that when I went to find information about the fast, mm-hmm. You know, there was a lot of wellness blogs that had a lot of pseudoscience in it, but when I went to try and find the science, not a lot there. So people do gravitate towards, towards sort of hokey things when they may not have other information available.
Yeah, and don't you also say, I mean, you seem, this idea of things that are free, that are easy, that are almost natural, seems to be a thread for you. You talk about that as well. You say that you raise the question that maybe there isn't that much science around fasting is because there isn't necessarily, maybe, or at least my conclusion is, there isn't that much money to be made.
There's virtually no money to be made. However, the fasting clinic that I went to was very expensive.
Right.
Because
that was detox, wasn't it? That was all detox.
Yeah, that
right.
was it. Yeah. But I think fasting itself, you know, you do need to go into it carefully. So it's free, but look, I would recommend that you do it with your GP or your doctor. There have been some studies, I think at UCLA, that has shown that fasting assists people in getting the best out of chemotherapy. So there's a couple of kind of studies around things like that. But it's really dangerous to, I think, test how long people can go without food and what happens to their body. It's, you know, ethically it's a bit of a conundrum. The only studies I could find about, how long you can go were things like studies on hunger strikers, the IRA guys, I think in the 80s in the British prisons. So I was drinking about 200 calories a day, and feeling very odd, and lots of strange things happened to my body over the 2 weeks that I didn't take food.
I think you get more than that in a shot of tequila, don't you?
You certainly do. But when I wanted to know what was happening to me, like why were my dreams suddenly vivid? Why suddenly did my eyes become very clear? Like what was happening with my nails and my hair that were suddenly really shiny? And, you know, my brain was all over the place. Like 1 minute I was really foggy. Then in week two I was super sharp. And there's not a lot of science around about that.
I promise you I've been listening, but I keep getting, as I'm flipping through your book here, I keep getting sidetracked by one-liners. Booze and parties still have their allure, but the allure is full of complications. It's just so funny. I was looking for, it cracked me up. It was your detox menu. And you ended up, and then the line that made me laugh, I can't find it. It's probably around that portion, but where, and you end up back to the cucumber. I mean, it just, but I think it's really important that people take that away, that you know, be careful of the fads. Don't step in necessarily without, you know, wise guidance. I think part of the problem for me is that, at what point, what are your reference points? Because what if the advice you're getting is already problematic, if you know what I mean? Like, how do you see the forest and the trees?
Well, you have to trust. I mean, a lot of the you know, there have been, it worked out fine for me. Although I'm not sure if it's like, I lost a lot of weight doing the fast, but as soon as I went back to my normal life, I put all that weight back on. So, long term, I don't know if it was very helpful. Cause it, you do need, your body does need food for fuel. And I found that, you know, being on a really, really restricted diet meant that I was not particularly active during that time. I guess the thing is to just always go to your GP, but people will do things that aren't necessarily proven scientifically because it makes sense to them intuitively. So, yeah, I did not offer any health advice in this book because, you know, it's a minefield.
It really is, and isn't it about context to some degree? And is it fair? I mean, everybody is so different, right? I mean, all of our systems are different. I mean, I struggle with sleep issues all the time. It's free, but boy, if you can't get to sleep, it's or you can't stay asleep. You know, that's a significant issue. So, talk to me about relationships a little bit, about community, about the wellness of that, the detoxification, and having a great conversation with an intimate friend, you know, over a glass of wine, heaven forbid, you know, you get to spend, is that the serenity that you're talking about, you're looking for, that there is healing to be found in community?
I think it's all to do with connection. So if you're disconnected from people around you, if your only relationships are online, if you're incredibly self-involved, you're going to feel, you know, anxious and depressed, and you're going to be searching for something to fill that gap. It's just a very human thing. But I found when I was fasting, you know, I took myself out of society for a couple of weeks. You know, I couldn't go to restaurants. I couldn't go to bars, obviously, or cafes. And so a whole area of connection, of meeting friends over a coffee, that was suddenly something I couldn't do. And I felt really lonely during the fast. You know, it was isolating, you know, being on such an extreme detox. And, you know, the wellness industry is quite individualistic. It's not necessarily about connecting you with a group of people. It's all about what can you do for yourself and your body?
Interesting.
And that's another thing to be, I guess, aware of when you engage with that industry.
You mentioned at the end of the book, you thank some of the eccentric folks that you met along the way, your journey. And I would imagine with the work that you've done over these years as a journalist and so on, the people that you met, you've got quite a long list. Can you tell us about a couple that stand out? Or anyone that stands out?
There were some shockers. There were some terrible. There were some real charlatans. And as a travel writer, you do get sent to wellness retreats and with the expectation that you write about people. And I remember being sent to this one very expensive retreat in Japan. And there was a wellness practitioner there who had clearly made it all up. She was absolutely, you know, she was seeing auras. She was, you know, rebirthing us. She was putting spells on us with chicken legs. She was just so, she delved into about 12 different spiritual traditions and was kind of using a bit of all of them and kept on losing track of what she was doing. And so, you know, you can laugh about that, but if you're someone who's in a lot of pain and is looking for answers, and you do go to a retreat or something where the person is just making it all up, then that can be a really dangerous thing. So, you know, there are a number of people like that around, but there are also some really great people. So I've had some amazing meditation teachers who've been just incredibly wise and, you know, have changed my life and the way I think about life. There's a big section in the book on yoga, and one of my yoga teachers, a guy called Adam, you know, I found the way he taught and his experiences really fantastic. He was affected by September 11. He was working downtown after the attacks, and he got quite sick from a lot of the dust, and his anxiety became quite bad. And so he went to yoga and meditation as a way of dealing with his anxiety. And, you know, so people who share their stories about how they've overcome certain things and then go on to teach others, I find those people really impressive.
Yeah, I don't know that I would say it saved my life, but I'm a huge fan of meditative yoga. I've tried the harder stuff, like, you know, the hatha yoga and so on. Yeah, that's out of my league. But the stuff where you can lie down and hold a position for 10, 12 minutes, I'm all in.
Yin.
Yeah, right. It's fantastic. Like, I'm terrible at the whole idea of meditation. I mean, it's remarkable what the mind will do when you try to focus. It really, truly is, or at least my mind anyway. But
I'm with it.
Yeah, no, for sure. And I'm with you. I think the question for me is, what would I be like without it? You know? And I think that's a good thing to keep front and center. You ask, I think if I remember correctly, you ask that funny, very funny question. Can you get addicted to yoga? Did you ever have that as a problem or an issue?
I'm terrible at yoga. I do it a lot, but I've never become any more than a beginner. I've never really graduated beyond, you know, the very easiest kind of classes. But I started doing it every day at a very intense studio in Bondi in Sydney, and found I became quite good at it, and my body changed. I became a lot more flexible. And I got a real rush from that, and I thought, I just want to do this every day for like 90 minutes a day. But of course, it became a complete nightmare to kind of live a life around yoga classes. But a lot of people do, particularly in Sydney. I know there's a huge wellness scene in Canada, particularly Vancouver. I think it's got a lot of Vancouver and Toronto are big wellness hubs, but definitely Sydney is as well. And people live for it. So look, it's a healthy addiction, but it's still an addiction.
Yeah, I think your comment about trying to live your life around the schedule of yoga is a really interesting starting point. and Bridget, is it really a just shy of a $15 trillion industry? Is that a real number? It's astounding.
So I just got an email from the institute that collates all the facts and figures. Let me see if I can find it. And it's gone up. So,
it's gone up. Yeah, of course it has.
Let's see. Sorry, it's on my email.
And then the final question, because we got to wrap it up, believe it or not. Maybe it's not the final question, but are you
more? Sorry. Yeah. Oh, can I just make a clarification? It's a $4.2 trillion
sorry,
industry.
Sorry, got it.
Nope. I've added an extra 10 trillion.
That's right. But still, it's a ridiculous amount of money either way.
Yeah, that is a lot of money. So,
it's insane. Yeah. It's just insane. It's so two final questions. Something you didn't know about yourself that you know now after this, you know, journey. And are you more clean, lean, and serene?
So something I didn't know about myself was that So I was brought up Catholic, and I've become sort of atheist agnostic since university. But doing this made me realize that, you know, everyone has a spiritual dimension, but it is shut down a lot by modern life. And that it is worth exploring that, you know, it is worth inquiring into, you know, that part of ourselves. And it's probably going to be a lifelong thing, mm-hmm. but I think it's worth turning our minds to. As to whether I've become more lean, clean, and serene, I've definitely not. but also, I'm more aware of you know, if I do start to slip into patterns of overindulging, I'm a lot quicker to kind of pull myself out of it.
Right.
And correct. I certainly don't want to live a life where I can't, you know, have birthday cake or champagne or, you know, I travel a lot. I love eating the foods in different countries. So it's just more about being aware of, you know, when you overindulge and trying not to do it too often.
What was Aristotle's line? Everything in moderation.
Except for moderation.
Yeah. I'm a huge fan. I don't know how you feel about Oscar Wilde, but I've always been a big fan. And the only thing I can resist, can't resist, is temptation. It's so good. Well, listen, what a wonderful time I've had today chatting with you. Thank you so
Same
much.
Here. Thank you, David. That was great fun.
Yeah. We've been having a chat with Bridget Delaney, talking about her pretty new book, Wellmania. You need to get it. It's available in a variety of different formats. Wellmania, Extreme Misadventures in the Search for Wellness. Bridget, thanks. Thanks again. Really appreciate your
time. Thank you so much, David. That was great.
Thank you.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hey, everyone. Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.
When everyone's on the same page, getting things done at work is easy. No matter what you do or what industry you're in, how you communicate is key. Everything you type is equally important to collaboration, and Grammarly can help. Think of it as your AI writing partner, empowering you to communicate effectively and efficiently so you can make a bigger impact in the workplace. 96% of Grammarly users say it helps them craft more impactful writing. And as the gold standard of responsible AI, Grammarly is your secure AI writing partner that allows your team to make their point and move faster. By understanding your writing in context, Grammarly provides relevant, personalized suggestions. And with tone suggestions, you can navigate even the most difficult work conversations. You can also save time from spending hours editing drafts to just seconds with one click. Sign up and download Grammarly for free at grammarly.com/podcast. That's grammarly.com/podcast. Easier said, done.